And this talk is going to have two parts, and the first part is basically a more or less a continuation of Jesse Peterson's talk. It's about joint work with Jesse, and it's about, so the title of this part is Three Subgroups, and it's about the existence of three subgroups under certain conditions, like positive first Betty number and quotient freeness, and also some additional conditions which I want to explain before I state the theorem. So we are still aiming at the study of groups with a positive first Betty number. And in order to phrase the conditions that I want to put on the group, I have to draw a little diagram, which one, so if the diagram exists, is usually called the validity of Atiyah's conjecture. Although Atiyah never conjectured this, but it's equivalent to something that Atiyah conjectured. So let gamma be a torsion-free group. Then you always have, say, the integral group ring, which sits inside the group for Neumann algebra. And this again sits inside the affiliated operators, which were already introduced in the talk by Jesse. And now Atiyah's conjecture predicts that there's some subalgebra which is generated by the integral group ring and which sits in between the integral group ring and the affiliated operators, which is a skew field. Right? And if you think about, so how does it, this skew field look like in very simple cases, so if gamma is just the integers, then of course this is just the own polynomial ring, and this of course sits inside, well, say, the rational functions in one variable, which I should call t, and this again is of course a subalgebra of the measurable functions on S1, so the restriction on S1 will be a measurable function, and of course this is a field, so since it's commutative, it's really a field. And Atiyah's conjecture predicts that there's always such a skew field replacing this field in the commutative case. And this is known for for some inductively defined class of groups, including free groups, and also a class of groups which is defined using residual properties, so the class is precisely the class of residually torsion-free elementary amenable groups. So that's in fact, I won't say anything about this class. But you see this conjecture, for example, it would explain that there are no zero divisors in this ring, because if it embeds into a skew field, then there are of course no zero divisors. But it's of course much, much stronger, and in fact, for some groups, it's easier to prove the existence of this Q field using, well, the analytic method, so it embeds here into these algebra of densely defined operators, rather than proving the zero divisor conjecture directly using, for example, combinatorial methods. And there's another conjecture which is slightly weaker, and that's called the analytic zero divisor conjecture. And this term was coined by Peter Linnell, which says that if you have A in the integral group ring and it's not zero, then A acts without kernel on L2 of the group. Of course, it's also a consequence of the existence of a skew field, but this is a priori slightly weaker. So if you would know this also for matrices or some appropriate matrix version of this, then it would be equivalent to the existence of the skew field, but here this is slightly weaker. And this is known for all known for right orderable groups. And that's really a large class of groups. So they are, I mean, although it's difficult to check for a particular group whether it's in this class, but it's still a large class of groups. So I'm assuming...
Isn't the analytic zero divisor conjecture implied that conjecture appears, right?
No, it doesn't. I mean, at least not immediately. Maybe you have a nice argument, but...
Well, so then can you repeat
Attiah's conjecture is saying that this is a skew field in between. So for example, if you have, I mean, of course, as an affiliate of operators, all these operators will be invertible. But if you take the sum of two inverses, there's, for example, not a simple reason why this, that should be invertible again. So. Now that's slightly weaker than this conjecture, and the usual zero divisor conjecture is even weaker than this. Okay. And now, the theorem is about groups which satisfy this condition star. So, let G be an infinite discrete group. And let's assume that the first Betti number is positive, and assume it's torsion free, and assume that this condition star is satisfied. Right? So it's a number of conditions, and we will see that at least the first two conditions that they cannot be avoided. So what's the conclusion of the theorem? So there exists an infinite family GI of subgroups such that, so first of all, the first Betti number of all these subgroups is zero. Secondly, the G, if you take out the identity element, it will be the disjoint union of the groups GI, where you, of course, have to take out the identity element, so that's this infinite indexing set for the subgroups. And the third condition is that for I different from J, GI is free from GJ. And what is this saying? So this is just saying that the natural homomorphism that you have from the free product from GI and GJ into J is injective. Right, so that's what it means to be free from another subgroup. Okay, and this has, of course, immediate consequences. So one corollary of this is that G contains a free subgroup. Well, just because this set is infinite, so in particular it contains more than one element, and if you take any element from GI and any other from GJ, they will generate a free subgroup since this map is injective. And we also see that more is true, so even taking any finite set in G, there will be some element in the group G which is free from each element in the finite subset. So this also just follows from the condition that this set is infinite. And this is a combinatorial condition which implies that the reduced C-star algebra of the group G is simple and has a unique trace. So that this combinatorial condition implies the simplicity of the C-star algebra, this is a result by Pierre de la Harpe. Okay. And of course, I mean, I didn't give you the proof, but it implies a lot more than just these corollaries. So another theorem which is related to this is that if G is generated by, say, n elements a1 to am, and you assume that the first Betti number of k of G is bigger or equal to k, well then there exists a subset of this generating set which consists of k plus 1 elements, so that's a subset which is free. Of the generators, which is free. So in particular, there's a very large free subgroup, and among any generating set of G, you can choose k plus 1 elements, which will generate a free group on k plus 1 letters. Well, this is all under the assumption that G, well, is quotient free and satisfies this condition star. And here, of course, the Betti number has to be not only positive, but bigger or equal to k. And this, it's again now an easy corollary, says something about the uniform exponential growth rate. So so for any generating set, you can define a growth function, and you say that the growth function is exponential if sort of it's exponential, and there's a certain exponent, which is the exponential growth rate. And of course, this might depend on the generating set, but since our result sort of applies to any generating set, there will be a uniform lower bound on this exponential growth rate. And if there is a uniform lower bound, then we say that the group has uniform exponential growth, and we can even give a precise lower estimate in terms of the Betti number. Under the above conditions, G has uniform exponential growth. And there's a sort of the obvious estimate for the exponential growth rate. So just using that you have a free subset in any generating set. Right. So if you have any generating set, you can define a length function and you count the number of the elements in the balls. And if it's exponential, you can remember the exponent. And yes, but does it apply to the exponential growth rate as well? To the uniform. The infimum over all finite subsets? Ah, okay. Well, then this might be a new proof, or at least a proof under more restrictive assumptions of the result, which was already known. But at least you see that it's just a corollary of this result, which was not known in this generality, so just assuming that the first Betti number is bigger or equal to k. So this was, for example, known under the condition that you have, say, n generators and only very few relations. So if you have a group with many generators and few relations, then you get a trivial bound on the first L to Betti number. And in this case, so for a group which was finitely presented, these results were known, but not in the general case where you don't have the trivial bound to give you this estimate on the Betti number. Okay, so, and in fact, so, the idea of the proof is really very simple. So if I want to give you the idea of the proof of this main result there, then it's just one line, and I define an equivalence relation on the group G, well, minus the identity element, by the following so you say that G is equivalent to H if and only if the following is true: whenever a co-cycle vanishes on G, it also vanishes on H. So I think one application is sufficient to have the if and only if. And this should hold for all co-cycles, one co-cycle is defined on G and taking values in either L2 of G or the affiliated operators. This doesn't make a big difference here. And this defines you, since the group is quotient-free, you can easily check that this is a nice equivalence relation, and that the equivalence classes together with the identity element form subgroups. And then, of course, this freeness is the only part we are really using the condition star. And if you want to have a result which doesn't involve this condition star, you can still prove that all these groups are Mayer-normal. So that's still true without assuming this condition star, but of course it's much weaker than having that these groups are free from each other. That's the result applying to groups with a positive Betti number, and also the results that Jesse presented were sort of interesting to understand the subgroup structure of groups with a positive L2-Betti number. But of course there are many groups like, for example, Kornhoff hyperbolic groups, which are also somehow negatively curved, like a free group, but which have a vanishing first L2-Betti number, and still you expect that some of the results that we showed for groups with a positive Betti number, that they extend to this more general setting. And for there you need a proper replacement for the notion of a co-cycle. So you need something which is a little bit more flexible. And I want to go directly to the definition. So a map from T into some unitary representation, so call it H pi, so this was studied also in the talk by Chess Peterson, is called a quasi one co-cycle. So if and only if the map which maps GH to the norm of G times T of H minus C of G times H plus C of G. So now taking the norm in the Hilbert space, if this is uniformly bounded. On G cross G. This is what I call a quasi-one cocycle, and you see if some quasi-one cocycle satisfies, or if some map satisfies the cocycle relation, then this map will not only be uniformly bounded, but it's zero everywhere. So in particular it's uniformly bounded. So all the one co-cycles give rise to quasi-one co-cycles, but in general there will be much more quasi-one co-cycles. So again, you have to, if you study these, there are some quasi-one co-cycles which are so for trivial reasons, and these are again precisely the bounded ones. So if you have a map which is bounded on G, then of course this will also be uniformly bounded. So using this, we define the first, well, quasi cohomology, and this is not another definition which I found, but it's due to Nicolas Monod, I presumably. And you take all quasi one cocycles and you mod out by the bounded ones. And that's precisely the same kind of definition that you had for the first cohomology, but now sort of in the quasi setting. And what is important is that there exists an exact sequence of the following kind. So you can consider the first cohomology of G with coefficients in the representation H, and this maps to the first quasi cohomology just by mapping a cocycle, a true cocycle, to the quasi-cocycle, which forgets that it was a true cocycle. And here you can just apply the co-boundary operator, which maps this quasi-one cocycle to a bounded two cocycle defined on the group. Right, so if you think about it, this up there is, well, it has to be a cocycle because it's a boundary of something. And you can even extend this a little bit further and go to the second cohomology. So I mean, the argument that this sequence is exact are very simple. And here I should HP But they relate rather interesting group. So this was the group which was measuring sort of the Betty number in case HP is the regular representation. And this is the group which appeared in the work of Chalon and Monod on rigidity and superrigidity. And this is sort of the guy in between, which for our purposes, or for my purposes in this talk, measures how negatively curved a group is. And similar to the definition of a positive Betty number, you can now define a class of groups which is given by those groups for which the dimension, Lux dimension, over the Feynman algebra of this quasi cohomology group of G with coefficients in L2 of G, where this is non-zero. And it's easy to see that as soon as you have a positive Betty number, then the group will be in here because it maps injectively to this group. Then amenable groups are not in here because both of these things, this is zero and this has zero dimension in this case. Well, and there are several other examples, and most importantly, you can show that all common hyperbolic groups are in this class because for those you have a natural construction of a quasi one co-cycle using geodesics. So, but I think I have 7 minutes or what? This, 10? Okay. So maybe I give you a short argument why the Kolmogorov hyperbolic groups are in this class. So that's theorem due to Mineev, or at least a slight reformulation of theorem of Mineev. If G is Kolmogorov hyperbolic, then G is in this class D. And for free groups, there's a very natural construction of a proper one co-cycle, which is just the following. So you look at the KD graph of the free group, which is just a tree, I mean, using the canonical generating set. And if you now map a group element G to the sum over the edges, so where I take the sum over all E which appear in a geodesic from the identity element to the group G, then this will be a map an element in L2 of the edge set of this KD graph. So this is in particular a very nice G representation, so it's almost Dirac, so it's just an amplification of Dirac representation. And since, if you want to compute the geodesic from the identity to G times H, then this is just first going to H and then going from H to GH, which is just, So it's, but you have to do it the right way. So it's first going to G and then going from the identity to H but shifted by G. So that's precisely what it is. So the co-cycle relation comes out of the uniqueness of geodesics, if you want. And now in a hyperbolic group, you, of course, don't have uniqueness of geodesics anymore. There might be many geodesics. But what you can still do is to to define this map by averaging over all geodesics. So that's what Mineev studied in his work on hyperbolic groups. And in fact, so the idea is now that averaging over all geodesics gives quasi one co-cycle if G is hyperbolic. Right. Okay, that's basically the idea how you produce out of the geometry such a quasi one co-cycle, and this also then basically shows that this is a non-trivial thing for hyperbolic, for non-elementary hyperbolic groups. So what's now the result? So the first theorem is that if H in G is semi-normal, so this was this relaxed normality condition that was already appearing in Jesse's talk, and G is in D, then also H is in D. So that's again just the same argument to show that the restriction map in the first quasi-cohomology is injective, and this implies that if here you have some positive dimension, you have to have some positive dimension here too. And if you think about it, you cannot expect much more, because there are fundamental groups of free manifolds, so there exists free manifolds which are hyperbolic, so that but they are bundles over a circle, so they are fibering over the circle, and this means that there is a map to the integers, and the kernel is some surface group. So in the surface group, this is finitely generated, it will be infinite at infinite index, so there's no way sort of getting around these examples if you want to treat general hyperbolic groups. But at least you see that the normal subgroup or the F-normal subgroup, it has to be in the class as well. So it has to carry some negative curvature if you want, if the big group does. So you will never find that a hyperbolic free manifold is sort of is a circle bundle over a surface. So that's well known, but this sort of you can see this from this result. And another observation is, and this is a little bit more tricky. So if G is boundedly generated by amenable groups, and it's itself non-amenable, and I'm thinking about SLNC, for example, for n bigger or equal to 3, then this first quasi-cohomology of G with coefficients in L2 of G say that this is identically zero. Not only the dimension is zero, but it's identically zero, saying that all these quasi-1 co-cycles are actually bounded themselves. So they're not even these examples which are almost bounded, which you have for amenable groups, but they are all bounded. So that's something that one can show. And then it's another observation that this geodesic co-cycle which we constructed for a hyperbolic group has the following property. So the geodesic one co-cycle, not the quasi one co-cycle on a hyperbolic group is proper. Right, so it's some sort of Hagerup property, but it's not quite every unitary representation which is allowed, but only the left regular, and it's not a one co-cycle, but a quasi one co-cycle, but again it's something in that spirit. And what this says is that the image of such a group, so if you consider now any homomorphism, consider a map from G to H, where G is boundedly generated by amenable groups, so like this, and H is comma hyperbolic, well then the image of G in H has to be amenable. And what's the argument for this? So if it would be non-amenable, then this image would be a group which would be boundedly generated by amenable groups itself, it would be non-amenable. Hence the restriction of this quasi-one co-cycle would be bounded on the group, but since it's proper, it follows that the image is finite, hence not amenable. So this is a contradiction to the assumption that the group was amenable. Right, so that's a very nice consequence. So you can never have such a group mapping non-trivially to a hyperbolic group. And another consequence is, if G is not only boundedly generated, but also has property T, then of course the image follows to be finite. Right, so whatever you have, for example, any higher rank lattice, and most of them, or at least conjecturally, a very, very large class of them, are as well boundedly generated and have property T. So any homomorphism from such a group to a Kolmogorov hyperbolic group has a finite image. And well, I don't know whether this was known or followed by other methods, but this seems to be a very, very general result.